This is an ABC podcast.
There's this lovely Chinese legend about how silk was discovered. It was said that the wife of an early emperor, Madame Shi Ling, was sitting under a mulberry tree when a moth cocoon dropped into her tea and it began to unspool in the hot liquid. And Madame Shi Ling realized that the thread would be strong enough to weave. This is one of the stories in Linda Javen's new book. Linda Javen has been fascinated by and immersed in Chinese history, politics, language and culture for more than 40 years. Linda has lived in China as a foreign correspondent, and she was in China during the massacres in and around Tiananmen Square in 1989. Some of her closest friends were leading the protests on that day. Linda has written a wonderful, concise history of China that pulls together thousands of years of culture and politics and philosophy. And this is quite a feat because China is both incredibly distinctive and yet defies any easy categorization. These days, the world is looking at Beijing with growing concern. Its wolf warrior approach to foreign diplomacy, its rhetoric about reunification with Taiwan, whether Taiwan wants it or not, seems bewildering at times, even self-defeating. So why are they doing it? Well, to find the answers, you need to look into China's deep, sprawling history, a history not many Australians are aware of. And it's there that you can find the stories, themes, ideas, and compulsions that keep recurring through the thousands of years of this extraordinary, brilliant civilization. Linda Javen's book is called The Shortest History of China. Hi, Linda.
Thank you. It's so great to be here, Richard.
Your book begins with a dedication. I'm quoting you. It says, "In memory of my parents who encouraged me to study whatever interested me, and what interested me was China." So how have you approached this, Linda, as a friend or as a lover or as a critic or as all three of those things?
I think it's all three because I think when you get to, you know, you get past the infatuation, during the infatuation phase, which I definitely went through when I was in my early 20s and learning all about Chinese history in university, and then landing in Taiwan, which was a marvelous place to live and study Chinese. I was so infatuated. When you're infatuated, you don't see the flaws or they seem very small. And then there's a point where you kind of discover the flaws and you think, am I in the right relationship? and they become a little bit overwhelming. And then it all just becomes this big, long thing. I mean, I talk about a relationship, but I mean, China doesn't take any notice of me. I take a lot of notice of it. So I suppose it's sort of one-sided in that sense. But for me, it's definitely a huge relationship in my life.
You first went to mainland China after Taiwan. It was still sort of crawling from the wreckage of the Cultural Revolution in those days. One of the big things of the Cultural Revolution was the campaign to destroy the four olds, old ideas, old culture, old habits, and old customs. Was Chinese history lost to Chinese people for quite a while at that time, or was it still remembered?
A lot of it was lost, and it was quite shocking to me. The first time I went to mainland China was in 1979, and I began going very steadily after that. And I remember on a trip in maybe 1980 or 81, I was walking around Beijing with the son of a professor who I'd met when he was visiting Hong Kong on some official business. And we went to a very famous Taoist temple. And it was completely abandoned and a bit still broken up and not really fixed yet. And I said something about Taoism, and he had never heard of the Tao Te Ching, of Lao Tzu's, of the classic of Taoism, which was one of the most important books written in China, an ancient book from the first millennium BCE. And I was like, what? And I thought, maybe it's my Chinese, you know, maybe I'm not expressing myself well. But that sort of thing would happen very regularly. And I began to discover the different memory holes. In different periods in the post-Mao era, there's been different degrees of tolerance with regard to assessing and looking at history, both recent and ancient. So, for example, now you cannot freely talk about what actually happened in the Cultural Revolution. There's an official line on that, and people have to stick with that, and you can't, you know, publish things that question that. But when I first was in China in the early 80s, there was a whole movement called Literature of the Wounded, and it was people who were writing it was fiction, but it also encompassed strong elements of autobiography and memoir, books that talked about the wounds and the violence and all of that of the Cultural Revolution. So what happens is, as books are banned in China, a certain generation may remember them, but they don't pass it on to their children because that's trouble for the children. So there's a lot of people whose parents know about things but don't tell them, because that could get them in trouble. Who wants your child going into class and saying, well, actually, what you're telling us isn't really the whole story? Because that could get you in trouble. It could get your, you know, would get the parents in trouble. It's just not worth it. People want their children to thrive, understandably. So these books, however, do survive. So that's how we can put together a history. So that with the shortest history of China, a lot of the books that I was looking at in terms of Chinese books were books that were published, say, in previous times that couldn't be published today or accessed today in China.
Reading your book, I had this realization that to talk about China is to talk about a nation state now. But it's also a bit like talking about Europe. It's that big, it's that diverse, and it's really hard to make general remarks about what Europe is, and Europe is like that. And the only thing you can, a few things you can say that Europe has in common is, you know, the Roman Empire and Christendom. When you talk about China, what is China then? What makes China, China?
Oh, Richard, that's such a good question. And I love the European analogy. I don't know. Mm. I hadn't thought of it, but I think I'm going to use it. I'll quote you.
Well, I often thought, like, you know, being in Shanghai, you go, or Guangzhou, you go, well, Hong Kong, this is a bit like Italy in a way, in some ways, you know, very mercantile, really lively. And then you go up to Beijing, this is like Germany. People look different and behave differently, and they're a bit more humorless. And, you know,
you've got that wrong about Beijing, by the way.
Okay.
The Beijing humor is unbelievable. Incredible. I love Beijing sense of humor. But yeah, I mean, the point is absolutely true. And the way I think about China is that it's useful to consider different ways that Chinese people themselves talk about China, the words that are used. And there's many, but there's two that I've focused on. And one is 中国, which implies the nation state, which is the idea of China as a nation, as a country. The other one is 中华, and 中华 is more about the civilization. So you can actually find bits of 中华 in Australia. You know what I mean? It's not bounded by geography, and it's not bounded by time. 中华 is an almost eternal concept, and it encompasses all of the different aspects of Chinese culture and civilization and invention and philosophy and art and poetry and everything else. Whereas 中国 is a more limited idea of China as a nation. So I think if you get those two different ideas straight, it's not that hard to talk about China. And one of the things that I try to do, especially in such fraught times as we're living in now, is to distinguish between, for example, the Communist Party of China and the Chinese. You know, you see sometimes in the media, people will say, the Chinese are building islands in the South China Sea. Yes, I mean, there are Chinese people there doing it, but they're part of the army which is being commanded by the Communist Party of China, which is under Xi Jinping. So you have to be very clear in how you speak, and I think that's more important than ever these days, with so much hostility and suspicion and tension between China and the rest of the world.
One of the ongoing problems when you look at great empires is the problem of succession. Who's going to rule after the current emperor? Now, democracy, for all its flaws, is pretty good at solving that problem insofar as you have an election, the person steps down, and a new leader comes along, and you can have succession and stability at the same time. The most stable period of the Roman Empire was when they had the period of the five good emperors, it was said. None of them had any male children, and so they were able to find a successor, select that a talented person, train that person and adopt that person into the emperor's family, and then the succession could pass quite smoothly from one competent emperor to the other. That wasn't always the case. Often it was the idiot son that got up instead. Linda, how has China dealt with this? Has this been an ongoing thing for China as well, the problems of succession?
It is a huge problem, and it's so interesting about Rome. And I think that one of the signs that democracy is in trouble is when you have somebody who won't step down, like Trump. Now, China has had problems with succession. It has been a headache for millennia. The problem is that Chinese succession, traditionally in the imperial period, was always from father to son. And it should be father to oldest son. But sometimes it seemed that the second son was the father's favorite or was more talented. And maybe you just had to kill the first son to get rid of him. Or the brother would kill you, you know, or whatever. There's a terrible amount of violence around succession in China. And there's been a lot of anxiety around it. And you do have these periods that are absolutely glorious, like in the Qing Dynasty, when you had three great emperors in a row. They had brilliant sons, and the sons became brilliant emperors, and that was all fine. But then things began to go bad, and not just because of bad choices or difficult successions, but because the system was not built to pick the best person for the job. So when they formed a republic in 1911, when a revolution succeeded in overturning the Qing dynasty, the last emperor abdicated, immediately, even though this was a new republic, there was a problem with choosing the leader, because Sun Yat-sen, who was the nominal leader of the revolution, his people and a lot of people who were in the revolution felt that he should be the first president. But there was a real troublemaker. A military man called Yuan Shikai just made an awful lot of trouble, let his soldiers run rampant, and that was his way of campaigning for the presidency. He then ended up subverting the whole system when he declared himself emperor of a new dynasty. And everything just kind of fell to pieces at that point. And we had what was called the warlord era. So there was always this problem.
Well, that brings us to the communist era. After the communist revolution of 1949, you had Mao Zedong becoming emperor for life, if you like. What ideas did he have about the succession? Who should succeed him and how it all should work?
Right. Well, the Communist Party, after the Long March, was holed up in the caves of Yan'an, and they were coming up with a lot of the theories that would guide their rule. And this one progressive journalist asked Mao, how do you propose to deal with succession? And Mao was like, oh, that's easy, democracy. because the Communist Party would say, and says to the present day, that they represent a kind of democracy. It's a different kind of democracy than the one that where you have multi-party, you have different parties and they can compete for, in elections and all of that. But I think people were a little bit shocked to realize that Mao's promise was not exactly what they were thinking. But he had a chosen successor, a military man called Lin Biao, who was his defense minister. Mao had called Lin his closest comrade in arms and chosen successor and all that sort of thing. Lin Biao is the guy who edited the little red book of Mao's quotations that everybody waved around in the Cultural Revolution. Anyway, suddenly, Lin Biao disappears from sight. And where did Lin Biao go? Suddenly, it was revealed that Lin Biao and his family had died in a plane crash over Mongolia while trying to escape to the Soviet Union after an assassination attempt on Mao. This was really shocking. And so even though, you know, we think, oh, Mao is the leader for life, it wasn't quite that simple either.
What about when we get to Deng Xiaoping in the 1980s, when he became the supreme leader of China? How did he try to solve this problem?
So we get to Deng Xiaoping. Mao died in 1976, and there were the power struggles behind the scenes were sort of working things out. Nothing much changed in terms of policy until, under Deng's guidance, he had become the effective leader. And the party adopted its program of reform, economic reform, and opening up to the world, which transformed China, which has, you know, that was the first step to the China that we know today. And they did think about this. So Deng only ever held one position. He didn't make himself chairman of the party. He didn't make himself president. It's very interesting. But he was the leader. There was no question about that. And then in the early 80s, they made a decision because succession really was on their minds. How do you do this? The decision they made was to limit the terms for the general secretary of the party, and the head of state would be, who were the same person, would be 2 terms of 5 years each. And that was the limit. So that's how they resolved succession. And it was still a little bit shaky at times, and people were purged and all this sort of thing. But by the time we got to Xi Jinping, the system was kind of working, right? There'd actually been a peaceful transition and all this kind of stuff. And then Xi Jinping, a couple of years ago, just under his guidance, the party abolished the 2-term limit. So again, China is thrown into this age-old problem of how do you manage succession?
So this is the dilemma that Xi Jinping has presented his people, in that he's wrecked this mechanism they had for a hand over this thin precedent that they had. That's just gone now, and so if you're contemplating a change of leader now, it's done through death or through him being overthrown and his family thrown into jail and everything else. So we're sort of back to square one in this sense with Xi Jinping, Linda?
Well, we don't know exactly how it would be managed. I mean, who knows? Because it's so opaque. But that is one scenario. Another scenario is that we all wake up and suddenly there's some announcement at a party congress, and suddenly we see that somebody else is there and Xi Jinping is whatever. I mean, you know, you don't know. But really, it has put him in a position where to challenge that position is actually going to be hugely disruptive.
Another big theme that comes through your book throughout the great stretch of Chinese history is the question of unity. Now, in the medieval era, I was reading in your book, the Chinese Empire was often at war with the Uyghurs, often at war with the Tibetans. So given this long history of conflict, why is modern China so insistent that these people are all part of the happy Chinese family?
Well, it goes even deeper than that. I mean, there's been many periods of China where the Chinese have been at war with each other. There's been different states. There's been different, you know, fiefdoms and so on, and they've fought each other. And so you have both the conflicts within what the Chinese call the Zhongyuan, or the central plains, which is the, more or less, you could consider it the Han ethnic stronghold, and then conflicts between that central area and the border regions, which would include Xinjiang and Tibet, and also a lot of the south, as well as the northeast. So China has come together as a nation state, and it's fallen apart, and it's come together and it's fallen apart. The first unifier, who's revered for this, he was Qin Shi Huang, terracotta warriors guy, who first unified warring states into an empire. He was the first actual human to call himself emperor. Before, that was a term given to sort of mythical or semi-mythical figures. And his reign didn't last very long. It was extremely tyrannical. And actually, that's left China with the question of, do you need tyranny to enforce unity? Also another eternal question. And every time you have disorder, it's costly, it's terrible. Human lives are lost, people's fields are trampled, there's just warfare, it's starvation, nobody's taking care of the dikes on the Yellow River, so there's flooding and more people die and all that sort of thing. So periods of disunity are viewed as anathema. They're viewed as really bad times. And then China, because it was surrounded by so many different areas with other ethnic tribes and peoples, from the Mongolians to the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, and so on. And so to secure its borders, it's always seen this as a combination of diplomacy and military action. The importance of Xinjiang, of course, is that the Silk Roads, the traditional Silk Roads that connected China with Europe and Persia and the Middle East, the subcontinent, these were important routes, and they went through a place that was full of people who were not ethnic, you know, Han Chinese. And so there was a lot of negotiation that had to go on all the time. And finally, in the Qing Dynasty, the Qianlong Emperor just went, right, let's just conquer it. And it was very difficult to conquer Xinjiang. They had to conquer it twice, and they're still conquering it today. It's an absolute tragedy, that story. But it's also, from China's perspective, it's 1/6, I think, of its territory, and it contains lots of natural resources, and it's also a buffer between China and a whole lot of potentially troublesome states, with Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as the Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and everywhere else in Mongolia. So these places are strategically important. And with Tibet, there's been periods where they had wars with Tibetan kings, and there were periods where they tried to woo Tibetan kings with diplomacy, including, oh, here's the princess bride. So the whole history of China's relations with its borders is one of trying to secure them by whatever means possible.
The other subject of this language of unity is the island of Taiwan. And Chinese leaders today will go out of their way to say that Taiwan is definitely part of China, despite all the mounting evidence that Taiwan wants to have nothing to do politically with mainland China, does not want the mainland to control them one little bit. They've got their own hard-won democracy and prosperity there. And when you look at the whole prospect of mainland China taking over Taiwan by whatever means, you can just see nothing but problems arising for China from that action. International economic sanctions, you can see perhaps even military action against it. I can just see nothing but downsides, really, to China wanting to take over Taiwan. And yet Xi Jinping still talks about it. So what is there in China's history that makes the prospect of reunification with Taiwan so attractive, despite all these problems?
And it goes back to that whole thing about unity. The person who unifies China is great. They go down in history. Qin Shi Huang was a tyrant, sure, but he unified China. It makes him a great leader, a problematic one, but a great one. It's very much valorized in historiography, this notion. But in the case of Taiwan, it's very much about the politics of the 20th century. Because Taiwan was not part of China until the Qing Dynasty. It was an island that was occupied by its indigenous people and other people who just fishermen and stuff who settled there. And then the big mass of Han who came there basically pushed them up the mountain. You know, they took over the better parts of the island. You had an indigenous population, you had pirates, you had fishermen, but it wasn't part of China. The Dutch got very interested in it, the Portuguese, that's why it was called Formosa. And then in the 19th century, China fought a war with Japan in 1894 and 1895. And China was absolutely humiliated by this, an Asian power, a small country that they once considered, you know, within their sphere of influence and, you know, nothing to worry about, certainly. Japan had become strong as the result of the Meiji Restoration. It beat China in this war. And one of the prizes that it took was the island of Taiwan. So Taiwan went from being a Manchu-ruled place to a Japanese-ruled place. And that was from 1895 all the way to 1945. And in 1945, when the Japanese surrendered at the end of World War II, they also handed back Taiwan to the Chinese. Now, that was Chiang Kai-shek's government. He had a lot to do. He wasn't that worried about Taiwan. So he sent a bunch of, I don't know, second-rate officials over there, very, very corrupt and cruel, massacring people and imprisoning people and completely putting the population who had initially welcomed the return to Chinese sovereignty offside. when Chiang Kai-shek and his people finally landed there in 1949, there was not a lot of really good feeling towards Chiang Kai-shek. So he had to rule there with martial law, and there were a lot of political prisoners, and there was a lot of dissent and everything else. I lived there then. It was very interesting. I lived in the late 70s. I lived in Taiwan for a couple of years. Anyway, they eventually got democracy, free elections, a free press, and so on in the late 80s. And Taiwan began to define its own identity openly and become more and more resistant to the idea that it had anything to do with the mainland. But in the mainland, it became this sort of holy grail to unify China, to take back Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau, to end the semi-colonial era, to end the civil war and all of this. And Xi Jinping is absolutely determined to make his mark with Taiwan, and the consequences be damned.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
You can't talk about China without talking about Confucius, Linda. He came along in the ancient Zhao dynasty. I hope I've pronounced that right. Tell me about what his philosophy of power was, which is the reason why he's remembered today.
Yes, it's a very practical philosophy. It's a philosophy of how you organize society and how you run things. So how you run a family and how you run government. And each one reflects the other. To put it very simply, his philosophy of society, of how a good society is ordered, is based on hierarchy. So the educated people are the ones who are the respected ones. They are at the top. The bottom is occupied by soldiers, and merchants are not valued. Artisans are more valued, but the peasants are right under the scholars. So the people who farm the land are valued. The other thing is about good rule. The father governs the family. It was very patriarchal, the way a prince governs the state. And that is through good moral example. It's not about laws, because laws just tempt people to break them. It's about showing an absolutely brilliant moral example. One of the ways you do it is through the enactment of rites and rituals, worshipping your ancestors, showing that you respect what has come before, and so on. So Confucius gave a very appealing picture of how people could rule. And he really sought to influence the rulers of his time. He was desperate to find somebody who would appoint him as an advisor. He got there once and everybody found him such a moralizing pain in the ass that court politics ended up with him being outproached.
Yes, Your Majesty, 70. You must rule by moral example. You've got to stop doing all this fun stuff and rule by moral example. So if he's going around saying this is how rulers should rule, not through legalistic means, they shouldn't legislate for virtue, they should just offer an example of a good moral leader. What happened when the Taoists came along? How different was their view of how power should work?
Well, the Taoists were completely uninterested in government. They were always the foil. The Confucians are the straight guys to the Taoists, comedians. But the Taoists were very serious about what they were doing, which is to find a way of living within the flow of nature. You don't fight things. You don't try to organize things. You don't try to push things into shape. You know, you just go with the flow. So the Confucians, because there were a lot of brilliant Taoists, the Confucians were always approaching the Taoists and saying, can you just come and help out here? And the Taoists were like, I'm fishing, thanks.
Well, there's this idea in Chinese philosophy that you should cultivate virtue, that you should sit there and you should really be mindful of trying to suppress the less virtuous things like greed and impatience. How did the Taoists see that idea?
Well, they also wanted to live as good people. So it wasn't like they were just complete rascals, and they, you know, there were a lot of rascals among the Taoists, but they weren't bad people. They believed that flowing with nature would create a better world, that if everybody stopped pushing against things that weren't meant to be, things kind of would smooth out. In the West, the Taoists were super popular in the 1950s. The Beat Generation loved the Taoists. Everybody and every hippie had a copy of what they would call the Tao Te Ching. And everybody knows about Confucius, even if they don't actually know what Confucius actually said. But I think it's important to look at the legalists. The legalists have sort of slipped under the Western radar a bit, and that's a real mistake, I think, for understanding China. Because the legalists were like, nah, right and wrong, who's to judge? It's what the leader says is right and wrong. So the way that you rule is you have a bunch of laws, and the laws reward people who do what you want them to do. That's what right is. And they punish those for doing what you don't want them to do. And that's how you rule. And so they were very practical. And all the way to the present day, we see the shadow of the conflict of those two, and I suppose the Taoists will throw the Taoists in there as well, the three schools of thought. Even with the communists, there's a real strong aspect to their propaganda and so on, which is about how morally right communism is, how this is definitely the high ground. And then you have at the core, as with just about every dynasty, you have a legalist core, and it's a very strong core of punishment and reward. And you can see that sort of encapsulated in the various social credit systems that are being trialed. And then you have the Taoists, who are basically, go away and leave me alone. And there have been times in China, including modern China, when it's fine. Yeah, just go away. But in the Mao era, they had to conquer the Taoists because everybody had to show up at a political study session and actively, positively endorse the Communist Party and Mao's ideas. You couldn't be a doubt. You couldn't sit back. You couldn't just go, oh, I'll just let that flow by me.
Yeah, so it was that totalitarian idea that the party really wanted to own your soul. It wasn't just like your obedience. It wanted your enthusiastic, genuine enthusiastic support. In fact, it had to have it.
Yes, exactly. And we're seeing a little bit of this coming back with Xi Jinping, who has been trying to get writers and filmmakers and all the rest onto a straight and narrow path. Whereas in the reform era generally, we've seen a lot of variety of ideas. And, you know, there was this time in the 80s when people just grabbed at everything and explored everything. That is not allowed anymore. Now the nation is trying to get everybody to think about history one particular way, make art and literature with a very nationalistic, pro-communist, with those sort of themes running through. There has to be positive energy, as she puts it. We're seeing Xi attempt to return to a more, I hate to use the word totalitarian because it carries so many implications, but a more complete guidance of society, shall we say.
I was in Shanghai some years ago, and I got talking with an author, Paul French, who has lived there. And I asked him one night, I said, how does the rest of China see Beijing? Beijing that was founded under the Mongol Yuan dynasty back in the 13th century. How do they see that great capital of Beijing? And he said, in Shanghai, he said, Beijing is seen as that place. It's full of the bureaucrats who work half as long as they do and get to make all the rules. So it's that's that classic resentment towards the bureaucratic capital. What is the relationship Beijing has often had to the rest of China?
Well, I must say, Paul French is an absolute Shanghainese.
Yeah, total. Absolutely.
He is so identified with that place. I like him. But Beijing has its views of the other places. So it has views of Shanghainese as being suspiciously semi-colonial, of being mercantile and small-minded, as opposed to the Beijing people who have inherited a lot of the Mongolian big-heartedness, big generosity gestures and all this sort of thing. It's not just politics, is what I'm saying. So Beijing has a kind of, which the Southerners more generally find a little bit frightening. The Beijing people drink like crazy. They're a bit more, in Chinese you say da feng, which is kind of a good thing. It's sort of a generous spirit, this big, big spirit. They swear more. They're very political. They have a lot of political jokes, and that's been the case for a very long time. It's a place to which people with political ambitions aspire. Yeah, as you say, other places are like, oh yeah, they make the rules. That's definitely true. But the Communist Party is always seeking to reinforce its connections with these other places. Now, what the Communist Party does reflects some of the better practices of Confucianism, in which bureaucrats were not allowed to rule the places they came from. So if you had somebody in the old imperial system who had qualified through a series of exams, civil service exams, to become a, we'll call them Mandarin, they would be sent to different places to rule because you didn't want the officials to have too close connections with the local power holders. So you kept moving them around. And the communists do something similar. Most of them will have had times when they were, say, party secretary of a distant province, and they had proved themselves through the way they ran that province. So Xi Jinping himself has had different experiences around the country. So Beijing is Beijing, but it's not like a fortress that has no connections with the rest of the country. The people who are in Beijing, and often at the higher levels, have had experience in different places. So it's more complicated than just saying Beijing makes the rules, because the people come from different places and they have worked in different places.
Linda, you mentioned the Qing Dynasty, the final Chinese dynasty that ruled from the 1600s up to 1912, when the last Emperor Puyi stepped down. Under the Qing Dynasty, China reached its dizzying apex. There was a golden age. But by the end of it, it had declined into backwardness and chaos. It had become the plaything of European and Japanese imperialists. It had suffered from the Opium Wars, one of the great crimes in the history of the world. I just wonder how this happened, and whether this came as a terrible shock when Chinese people woke up one day to see foreign high-tech navies parked on their coastline, realizing that they were no longer the premium world power.
It was an incredible shock. And that's when you get revolutionary ideas that grow out of this kind of situation, because people are thinking, okay, there's something about our old ancient system that isn't working. We've been thrust into the modern era, not in a way of our choosing. As you say, the Opium Wars were a terrible crime. They were wars fought by Britain and France and other places to force the Chinese to buy opium.
So what happened there, Linda? Why was China so prone to being this country that was, I think, still at the time, the most populous country in the world and had once been the most advanced country in the world? How did it fall so hard?
So one of the questions is, why did Chinese scientific and technological innovation begin to dry up around the Ming Dynasty, so between 1368 and 1644? And that's a much debated issue. But by the time of the Qing Dynasty, 1644 and onwards, the innovative technological and scientific vigor of the past was really not so present.
So what happened was, did they just decide they didn't want it anymore, or they thought that technology was too disruptive? And was there a decision to not go ahead, to actually?
No, there was no decision. It was a combination of different things. I mean, I still think it's a bit of a mystery. I don't have a solid thesis on that, so I'm not going to speculate. But when we get to the Qing, they don't have the traditional vigor. In the Ming Dynasty, there was a Chinese maritime force under a Muslim eunuch admiral called Zheng He, and that was the only time that China sent out expeditionary forces who indulged in trade, in diplomacy, and in projection, what we call now projection of power.
It makes you wonder whether China might have even colonized Australia before Britain managed to do so.
There's no evidence, despite that very popular book that was written about him, that he reached Australia. Anyway, they weren't colonizing. They were making very strong diplomatic relations with people, but they weren't colonizing. But the thing is that kind of stopped. There was always a conflict between scholars and eunuchs in the courts, and the scholars were like, these are very expensive. Let's just get rid of the map so it can't continue. there were just lots of things that came together. In the Qing Dynasty, one of the things that happened was there were imported crops, including sweet potatoes and other things that grew really, really well, which contributed to food security, which contributed to population growth, which contributed to food insecurity, especially as the bureaucracy didn't grow along with the population. So the government began to get out of touch with people. And there's always been a problem in Chinese dynasties when the government loses touch, when they become corrupt and they're not doing the infrastructure that keeps people from dying in floods and means that they have grain stores so that they can eat in times of famine. The Qing proved really incapable of dealing with these military threats and economic threats and so on. People were saying, look at Japan, look at what's happened. And so after Japan beat China in this war, lots of people flocked to Japan in the late 19th and early 20th century because they saw this as an Asian power that had modernized and grown strong.
So jumping ahead now to the communist era, after 1949, the Chinese communists take power and we have the figure of Mao Zedong. When I think of Mao Zedong, the quality that always comes to mind with me is his astonishing recklessness. Did Mao see himself as part of a long tradition of Chinese emperors, or did he think he was a complete break with that?
I think he thought of himself, I think, as more of a tradition of rebels. And so some of the people who, like the communists immediately valorized as heroes, they overturned the traditional historiography in which you would have these model emperors and so on. And under Mao, you looked at some of the great anti-imperial rebels. And so that is more where he put himself. And he was all about continuous revolution, constantly upturning, you know, what you set in place as a way of progressing.
So he was kind of like bored by government, in other words, the drudgery of government. And this is why he led the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward. It's like, I was happier being a revolutionary leader, even if it means revolting against my own party in this case.
Well, he more saw it as the party revolting against him. So in each case, especially in the Cultural Revolution, bombard the headquarters became the cry. It was about getting out the revisionists and the capitalist roaders and so on. In other words, his critics and enemies within the party. It was more like he saw the party rebelling against him. And he was very frustrated that things weren't moving fast enough. You know, people weren't doing things fast enough. This is in the 1950s. He was also very troubled by the death of Stalin because he saw Stalin as the greatest, you know, this wonderful friend of China and a fantastic leader and a model. And then Khrushchev denounced Stalin. And this was just shocking to Mao. So all sorts of things were going on with him.
When we get to what happened at Tiananmen Square in 1989, you were in China when the shooting started. You had friends in Tiananmen Square, some of whom were leading the protest there. Now, this was more than 30 years ago now when that happened, Linda.
Amazing.
Now that you've written this long history of China, where do you place that? How do you see that event in the longer stretch of Chinese history?
I think it probably parallels most closely, even though it's quite different, but there are certain parallels with the May 4th movement of 1919, in which young people, seeing their government as problematic and seeing ideas from outside in the May 4th movement, also this was about democracy that they saw elsewhere. So the government was seen as corrupt and ineffectual. The 1989 protests began, as many people have forgotten, with anti-corruption slogans. It began as an anti-corruption movement. And the corruption then is nothing as compared to the corruption now, but it was so sharp. I had a very, very close friend, an old man who was my sort of, I don't know, my adopted godfather or something. He joined the communists because he was so angry at the corruption of the KMT in the 1940s. He joined the communist cause and supported it and suffered a lot over the years. But in the 1980s, And then he joined the party. And then in the 1980s, he was just furious. He said, this corruption that we're seeing now outdoes what I saw in the 1940s. And so you had this sort of sense of complete outrage. And it really, when you look at it now, it looks quite not innocent, but the degree of corruption was quite small, but it was also very obvious.
Perhaps it's in a part of the cycle of systemic corruption and a moral revolt against that.
I mean, if we look at it that way, 1989, we can see it as a continuation of a very, very, very old cycle of protest or rebellion that happens when a regime gets so corrupt it's no longer looking after the people.
Linda, today, when you look at the Belt and Road Initiative of Xi Jinping, that name, the Belt and Road Initiative, how far back into China's history does that name reach?
Well, they draw on very specifically the Silk Road, which began kind of in the Han Dynasty, which is sort of contemporaneous with the Roman Empire. There was a lot of trade that began going out from the central plains through the deserts and so on of Xinjiang and then beyond to connect with the rest of the world. And the belt is the maritime connections made by Zhenghe.
That's going back like to the late medieval era then, in other words.
Yeah, these are concepts that draw on this notion of China being a place that is deeply connected to the world, both diplomatically and economically. And of course, there are elements of security as well, because the Chinese established garrisons along the Silk Road. And those garrisons were armed, and they were, because there was a lot of piracy and everything else, those garrisons that were set up are the basis for contemporary claims by the Communist Party that Xinjiang has always been part of China. But it really was just garrisons along the Silk Road. They didn't rule Xinjiang, like military garrisons in this no man's land, in this contested territory. So what I'm saying is that the road has economic, diplomatic, and to some extent security/military aspects.
You know, sometimes when we talk about the current alienation of Australia and China, the growing hostility in the language that's used, it's often attributed, sometimes attributed, to Australia's historic racism, Australia's historic paranoia about the yellow peril coming from the north. But all of this, it seems to me, Linda, seems to forget how much genuine excitement and friendship and goodwill there was in Australia 15, 20 years ago towards China and to China's rise and reascendance as a major world power. The CCP line at the moment is that Australia, just as because of racism, has always feared and resented China's rise. And that's just not true. What do you think of all that?
I think it's crazy and it's so sad, because I remember so well the 1980s and how much sheer excitement there was about cultural exchange and about visits, mutual visits, and the idea of traveling in China. And the Terracotta Warriors, you know, which we mentioned earlier, they came to Australia and people would just queue to see them. It was so exciting. There was so much excitement around this relationship. And I think it's really important not to forget that. I'm really glad you brought that up, Richard.
Because well, I think a lot of people still love China, despite what the CCP is doing. China, like the Chinese people they know, the Chinese culture they love, that whole world, still love it in spite of what the CCP is doing. Maybe, and I don't see that going away, do you?
Well, I do fear that the way that universities are restructuring with such an emphasis on which courses have practical usage and so on, what we're seeing is a disappearance of deep knowledge. You know, you need to study Chinese language, ideally classical Chinese language and so on. The people who kept those ties really vibrant were people who... Yes, there were a lot of people who didn't know Chinese, but there were also a lot of people in there. I mean, Kevin Rudd was a diplomat. Jeremy Barne was a scholar who was doing all sorts of writing and doing and all this sort of thing. He eventually went on to found the Center on China and the World at the ANU. You had a lot of people from that time who were able to really go deep in that connection. And we need to sustain that. And now with this horrible this feeling and this tension and this, you get the feeling that China is a geopolitical matter. And who wants to go and study Chinese when you're just going to be, you know what I mean? Like, what is the, when I think in the 80s and the 90s, there was a sense that China is such an interesting place in itself. And there are opportunities, whether it's, you know, whether you want to go into trade with China or whatever, there was a lot more enthusiasm that went through to the point of creating an atmosphere for China literacy that I think we're missing now, and it's a real lack.
Linda, it's been amazing to speak with you. This is an extraordinary story, and I've so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh, I have too.
Linda Javen is the author of The Shortest History of China. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.